Okay, good afternoon. As you can hear, the microphone is working. In fact, it's quite loud, isn't it? It's okay? All right. It's very hard for me to tell because I can sort of hear it's working, but not more than that. Right, good afternoon. Welcome to week 7. Before I start with the lecture as such, I'd like to go back to a topic which I briefly touched on a while ago in one of the first lectures. I mentioned that there was going to be a number of trial lectures for the new, for the replacement for a former colleague who retired. And I mentioned back then that it would be very important or very good for you to attend several or all of these talks as far as that's possible. Because we're basically selecting the person who's going to be teaching you later. You're going to write the final thesis with them, or, well, it's just basically one of the three linguistics professors in the department, and you have a say in that. Your voice, your opinion will be recorded on a piece of paper. This is done by the Fachschaft. And this will then feed into the discussion in our meeting after the talks. As you can see, they happen on the 11th of December and the 12th of December, and then there is a later one on the 20th of December. This is because Dr. Schleif is currently in New Zealand, and it's a long way from New Zealand to come here. And he asked us whether it was possible to do it a week later, and the other option would have been to see him on Skype or some other way. We felt it was better to actually meet the person in the flesh in order to get a better impression. So as you can see, there are four talks per day. 2 in the morning, 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and then 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock. On the 10th, no, that was the plan, but it's, well, anyway, you'll see these posters hanging around the department. I'll also upload it to StudIP. There will be a half an hour talk. This will be followed by an open discussion where you can ask questions. Okay. And then there will be a meeting just with the committee, and then on the basis of this information, we need to decide who we're going to invite to join us. Good, I just wanted to mention this. It is quite important. It may seem a long way off for you, but I do think it is worth attending those lectures. Right, let's start the slides. Here we are. Right. Apart from that, no announcements really, apart from the fact that I'd like to remind you of the assignment, which I know many people are working on. I've already received a few. I've also had a few questions from students who didn't quite know what I expected or couldn't find things, and then it turned out it wasn't as easy as they thought, perhaps, or they looked somewhere where I didn't expect them to look. I hope you've now seen that this assignment isn't just intended to be tedious, but it's actually supposed to familiarize you with something that you may otherwise not see or know about. And that's what I would like to make sure isn't the case. Right, so that's the only thing I'd like to say. Deadline is soonish. What was it, 10th of December or something like that? Yes, okay. Well, soonish. You still have more than 10 days, but please don't forget about it. Right. The second thing I'd like to briefly say is, come back to something which I mentioned last week when I introduced the difference between morph and morpheme, and I'm not going to introduce the difference between morph and morpheme anymore. I did introduce the concept of allomorph as well. For example, the voice and the voiceless. Z and S, both meaning plural. Okay, and I said that they're allomorphs because they've got the same meaning. Okay. Later on in the lecture, those of you who listened carefully, you might have noticed that I occasionally just said morpheme. And when I was talking about an actual thing, this is a morpheme. Well, actually, of course, it's a morph which realizes a morpheme. So if I say something like kids consists of two morphemes, well, actually, of course, morphs, but it doesn't really matter that much anymore as long as we know what we talk about. This may not be very helpful to you, but if you want to make the distinction between this is an actual morph and it is the actual thing that we see rather than the abstract entity, then it's important to make that distinction. But if you just want to refer to what are the parts of this word morphologically, you can call them morphemes. Okay. And that's what you sometimes will see in the literature as well. So don't get confused by this. The distinction is the same as between phone and phoneme, actual realization versus abstract concept. But sometimes linguists are not consistent when they use the terminology when it comes to morphology. Okay, I hope that didn't confuse you any further. So it's okay to say morpheme if you know the difference between morph and morpheme. But you need to know the difference between morph and morpheme. All right? Good. Okay, I think you feel cold, right? I always feel warm in a lecture. So. Right. Good. Grammar today, or syntax, the first of four fun lectures, right? You're going to be introduced to concepts which I think most of you should actually know. I have a 9-year-old son who's now in year 4 of primary school, and he recently came home with homework, and he had to look at the different parts of a sentence, and he had to say things like sort of adverbiale der Zeit or something like that. He used rather technical terminology as well. And he had to distinguish between subjects and objects and between, well, all sorts of things. And I was surprised, and I thought, oh, this teacher is expecting quite a lot. And then I asked my colleague, and she said, no, that's what you do in primary school in Germany. So you should really know all of this in a way. I know it's a long time ago, and you forget again after a while. But I think all I need to do, or at least all I hope I think I need to do, all I hope I need to do is to revive some of those fond memories of working with grammatical categories. Okay. Before we do this, a few thought beliefs about grammar. Maybe this isn't so much the case among Germans, but if you ask the lay person on the street in Britain, you will very often hear statements like this. I don't know any grammar. It's something that also in Britain for a long time wasn't explicitly taught in schools. So that's what people believe, that they not only, well, that basically English doesn't have any grammar to know about, or at least if it does, they don't know it. Yeah, exactly. English doesn't have much grammar. Most has been lost. Well, it's true, and you'll hear more about that next semester, that English has lost things that have to do with grammar, inflections. If you compare English and German, then you will know that, or then you will see that German has many more inflection, or the inflectional morphology of German is much more developed or elaborate than that of English. But that's not all there is to grammar. And then you hear a lot of things like this, a lot of rather dubious statements of the following kind. Sloppiness leads to bad grammar, which in turn leads to imprecise communication, or worse. People start bashing each other up if they speak bad grammar, right? That's the kind of implications that people often would like to, often call upon. In fact, these kind of things aren't recent developments. If we look in the preface to the Dictionary of the English Language by Samuel Johnson, that was 1755, quite a while ago, he basically postulated something fairly similar, namely that English has no grammar, or that there is so little left that he shouldn't need to write about it. He wrote the following, "The established practice of grammarians requires that I should here treat of the syntax. But our language has so little inflection or variety of terminations that its construction neither requires nor admits many rules." Well, yes, inflectional morphology, there isn't much around, but it doesn't mean that there are no rules. It doesn't mean that there isn't structure, which is in fact quite elaborate, which is just differently organized from that in other languages. Other languages which have more inflectional morphology. And then there are people who really feel quite strongly about bad grammar. I have a fictional dialogue here between the two people. There's lots of whispering going on there. Can you please stop? Thank you. Otherwise, I need to start whispering too. Okay. Jim says very defensively, "So I don't see why anyone should accept that kind of rubbishy remark." Michael is pressing the point home, "But if you want to really get an insight into it, you..." "What sort of language is that?" Hello? So, "to really get, that's typical of the careless way you people put things. If you aren't going to use proper grammar, I don't see why we should take your sort of view seriously." What's wrong? What's driving him up the wall? Anything that you find wrong? Yeah?
Maybe that the really isn't the right place, it should be behind you.
Behind you? Okay. So you said, and you phrased it nicely for the present purpose, isn't in the right place. So you made basically gave a value judgment about it's in the wrong place. Okay. From that person's view, of course. I'm not saying that this is your view. But you said you say it should be. But if you really want to get, right? Okay. What's wrong with it? The really is in a place where it shouldn't be according to certain people because... Exactly. A lot of people get upset about the fact that the infinitive is split and you've used the right terminology. This is a split infinitive. There are some very famous split infinitives around. Does that ring a bell to you? I mean, I know most of you watch this in the dubbed version, but what's the split infinitive that you link up with Star Trek? "To boldly go where no man has gone before," right? Does that sound familiar to you? Yeah, okay, some people know, yes. Right. This is a split infinitive which has sort of become almost idiomatic, but some people don't like it. So they, for example, when they talk about a sentence like the following, that we've just heard, "But if you really want to get an insight into it," okay, then that's okay. "If you want to really, if you really want to," did I say that right? Well, it's so natural to use a split infinitive there, right? "If you want to really get an insight into it," okay, and then we could theoretically have an option, "But if you want to get really an insight into it," do you like that? I don't. Number one is correct in inverted commas according to prescriptivists, those people who think that they know what good grammar is. The second one is the split infinitive, and the third is, I don't want to say wrong or incorrect. It's just unidiomatic. It's something that native speakers wouldn't use. Now, if we want to talk about this kind of thing, then we're talking about variation between two options, basically number one and two. And that variation seems to carry some meaning, some implications. Well, we know more about, possibly, or we think to know more about the person who speaks. Must be a sloppy speaker. But basically, it's variation in terms of structure. Now, in order to be able to discuss this, or to be able to talk about things like this, what is possible in language and what isn't possible in language, we need to know the terminology. We need to use the term split infinitive, which is exactly what this is about. So basically, we need to talk about categories of grammar. We need to know about structures of sentences. We need to know about the building blocks of the language that make up what is considered an acceptable, grammatical, correct, in an inverted commas, let's call it idiomatic English sentence. If we have a sentence like the following, the car green, the door red with, then you have no problems finding out or feeling or reacting to this in a way that says it's wrong. Okay? It's an impossible sentence. We say the green car with the red door. Why shouldn't we say the car green with the red door? If you know French, then the French are perfectly happy about putting adjectives after the noun. The English hardly ever are. There are some exceptions. Okay. With the red door, those of you who know Japanese or some other languages know that prepositions don't exist in Japanese, as far as I know. I don't know any Japanese, but I know that there are postpositions. So what we would put before the noun follows the noun in Japanese. So in English, adjectives normally, and that's now using technical terminology, adjectives normally pre-modify nouns, and we normally have prepositions rather than postpositions. But as I've just said, different languages have different rules. Now this is about putting things next to each other because of structural rules. There's also a famous sentence that goes, colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Don't know whether you've heard this sentence before. This was used by Chomsky, a famous linguist, to make a few points. And the point here, of course, that he makes in this context is that this is not an acceptable sentence. But it's not an acceptable sentence not because of the structure, because the structure is fine. But there is something about its meaning, the semantics. You can't be both colorless and green. You can be both colorless and, I don't know, happy or something like that, or expensive, but you can't be both colorless and green. So in terms of structure, it's the same, but it still doesn't work. So there's more than just structure, but in the next few weeks we're going to be concerned about structure alone. After that we'll move to semantics, which is basically what this is about. Of course semantics and syntax interact, but sometimes you can have a perfectly acceptable sentence syntactically that just doesn't work semantically. And this is one of the examples, colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Okay, one term that I briefly introduced in an earlier lecture was part of speech. Okay. Word classes. We talked about open and closed word classes. And word classes are typically, I've given you the traditional approach already, and I made the point that these are categories that are not clear-cut. But I'll give you the traditional approach again, and I'll do this in the form of a little, I don't know, poem or something like that. Every name is called a noun, as field and fountain, street and town. In place of noun, the pronoun stands, as he and she can clap their hands. The adjective describes a thing, as magic wand or bridal ring. The verb means action, something done, to read and write, to jump and run. Okay. This is the kind of thing that primary school children would learn in Britain. How things are done, the adverbs tell, as quickly, slowly, badly, well. Last week it was really nice when you were all quiet. I was wondering, what's happened? No one's saying anything. Today you're quite bad. Yes. Quickly, slowly, badly, well. The preposition shows relation as in the street or at the station. Conjunctions join in many ways, sentences, words, or phrase and phrase. Okay. The interjection cries out, hark, I need an exclamation mark. Now this is, as I said, the traditional approach, and if you think about it, then it relies on a number of criteria. Every name is called a noun. Is field a name? Well, maybe we need more, we need better categories than that. Linguistic criteria. And in fact, in linguistics, we typically have three types of criteria to determine part of speechhood, or part of which part of speech it is. Meaning, in other words, semantics. Morphology and distribution. Semantics we'll be talking about much more later. Morphology we've covered. What do I mean by distribution? Well, I'll show you in a minute. Let's briefly talk about aspects of meaning that might help us in determining whether something is a noun or a verb. Nouns relate to names or are names of entities. So, we have no problem saying cat and dog and table and hat are nouns. Fine. Verbs are actions, processes, states, and events in terms of meaning, right? So, to be, to stand, to run, to attack, to build, for example. Adjectives, in terms of their meaning, are properties of other entities, of nouns. Yellow, big, unknown. Now the problem with this kind of division is that it is very easy to find counterexamples or problem cases. Victory, noun, is that the name of an entity? Victory isn't really an entity, is it? Destruction. That's an action, isn't it? The destruction. It's clearly not an entity that I can touch. Globalization? It's not even an entity, is it? I mean, happiness? Mm. Or, if we look at the following list, teacher, table, doorway, sky, have a swim, and arrival. Are these all entities that you can link up to the semantic category that I just introduced? Well, teachers and tables you can touch, I guess. These are sort of entities that are clearly there. Okay, so it's persons and things. Yeah, fine. Doorway and sky. I mean, can you touch a doorway? You sort of can go through it, but it's much less tangible. Right? It's a concept. It's not the same thing. A sky, well, the sky, you don't really touch. If you try, then you're never quite there, right? And even worse, have a swim and arrival. These are activities and events. So clearly semantics doesn't help us enough in determining whether something is a noun or a verb or something else. Just to bring that point home a bit further, I'd like you to think about what the word classes of the following words are. Apple? Who thinks it's a noun? Most of you. Who thinks it's not a noun? Not necessarily. I come to that in a minute. Washing? Verb? There are a few others that I'm not going to go into, but these are all potentially problematic or debatable. There, to, the infinitive marker, now, today, in front of, I made the point last time, is this one word or is it more than one word? And a tag question like, isn't it, which often is reduced to in it, okay. Is that, what's the word class of that? It's cool, innit? Innit? Yeah. Now, I don't have time to look into all of these. Some people say now is an adverb. Others say it's a preposition. And they can argue for this. Okay. We're not going to do that now. But apple pie, what is apple in apple pie? It says something about what type of pie it is. It's not a green pie. It's not a heavy pie. It's not an expensive pie. It's an apple pie. It is something like an adjective. Of course, apple is usually a noun, but where it is now, it is actually like an adjective. Or you could say it's a noun-noun compound, but it's not quite clear. Washing machine. Is that still a verb? I'm not sure. Now, if I'm not sure, then that's because it is currently, the word that I'm talking about, is in a position where we would usually find something else. And this is, therefore, a case where I'm arguing on the basis of distribution of where it is in the sentence. So typically we have a word with a particular word class or being a member of a particular word class occurring in connection with or in conjunction with or next to other typical words or typical structures. Nouns very often, not exclusively, but very often appear after the. Not all words following the are nouns, but it's probably not a verb. You'll find it very difficult to find a sentence where there is a verb following the. Unless I'm saying something like, the word the is a word, right? Then I have the and is, but that's not the same as what I'm referring to. Verbs can be in particular types of constructions, like progressives or perfective constructions. If I have a slot that needs to be filled in I am ing or I have ed, then what I'm going to put in there is a verb. That's purely on the basis of distribution. Adjectives can occur as part of comparatives or superlatives. So if there is a more or a less or the most or the least or something like that in front, then it's likely that what follows is an adjective. So that's something quite different from semantics, and sometimes the information might be conflicting, as it is in apple pie. We know that apple is a noun, meaning-wise, semantics-wise, but structurally, in terms of distribution, it functions like an adjective. There is a third one, and that is morphology, that helps us determine word class. For example, adjectives can have inflectional morphology that indicates comparison, or the superlative as well. If a word ends in ER, there is a good chance, although not exclusively, that it might be an adjective. Verbs have ing endings, or ed, or es. Nouns typically have a plural that ends in s, although last week we saw that there are nouns like oxen and sheep. Now, if you think about it, this is really distribution as well. It's just distribution at the word level. So some people say word class really depends on meaning and distributional information, be it at the word level or higher up. Okay, these were some preliminaries. I'd now like to introduce a very, very important distinction that's going to keep us busy a little bit, and that's the distinction between form and function. We can describe the same sentence in two different ways. We can describe its form, which means that we will look at what type of words it contains, how these words are put together, what kind of sentential structure it has. But we can look at how individual elements in this sentence carry grammatical functions. Okay. And this is a major division that we need to, be able to understand and work with. So if I ask you what's the function of the man in whatever sentence, and you say it's a noun phrase, then it's not the function. But I'll come to that in a minute, because then you've said something about form. Okay. So this is an important distinction. I used to live in Lancaster, which is up north, and up north in England. And that's why I chose the sentence, I like Lancaster in spring. As I said, there are two ways of describing the sentence. I can say I is a pronoun, so I'm now saying something about the word classes. Like is a verb. You know all of this. This is not Ling 101, this is primary school. Okay. But we need to start from the basics. Lancaster is a noun, and in fact it's a proper noun. Okay. In is a preposition. And spring is again a noun. Easy. That's form. But of course, and again, I think you know all of this, I is a subject. Lancaster is an object. In spring, something else, we'll leave it open for the moment. Like, well, it's a verb, yes, that's true, but verb is form. In terms of function, we might want to call it differently. I'll come to that later on. So this is function. Notice, by the way, that I put in spring together. Before, when I looked at form, I said that in is a preposition and spring is a noun. Now that's obviously because in spring together performs one function. In alone, in this sentence, doesn't perform a function on its own. So, in spring, is a unit. In fact, we will call this unit a phrase. And the phrase performs a particular function. So, we have I, which is the subject, and then what's the rest? And I'm sure you will have heard, or also read about, the fact that, like Lancaster in spring, is then called the predicate. And in fact, we will call like the predicator, but that's not on the slide. Okay. So, form versus function. If you think about the sentence, can you tell me whether all parts are equally important in the sense that we require them to have a fully idiomatic sentence or not? And it'll be easy for you to say no, that's not the case. You can remove in spring. You can just say, I really like Lancaster. Not only in spring, but I like it all year round. And then you could just say, I like Lancaster. That's because in spring is circumstantial information. In spring performs a function or has a function that doesn't seem to be necessary for the sentence to be grammatical. So I can say I like Lancaster, Can you remove anything else? Like in Spring? Not really. I mean, almost everything is possible, almost anything is possible in spoken language. But this would be very odd or marked or very informal. Let's just call it non-idiomatic. Notice that I put a little asterisk there. This is a very typical or a convention in linguistics that when we present examples that are not idiomatic, not correct or not acceptable, then we have a little asterisk. Sometimes when we're not sure, we put a little question mark, which then typically means that there might be some people who accept it and others who don't, which is a very common situation. So with a split infinitive, okay, the split infinitive is not really debated, but we could say, we could put a question mark there for some people, this is not acceptable. Okay. I can't say I like, because something needs to be liked. Mm-hmm. Like Lancaster in Spring. Again, you could, of course, in spoken language say, oh, this is great, yeah, like Lancaster in Spring. But then like is not a verb. When like is a verb, then you really need something that likes or somebody that likes. So there is a participant missing. If you have like, you need something that is liked. And if you have like, then they need someone who does the liking. This is a grammatical rule. There's no inflection involved, but it's still a grammatical rule. And all speakers of English know this. They know about grammar if they know about this rule. Some verbs require objects while others don't. Okay. Yes, you. Okay. The boy stumbled. We have a verb and we have the boy. But there is nothing that stumbles. Well, there is something that stumbles in the sense it's the boy, the subject, right? But there isn't anything else required. So, in other words, when we look at the sentence, we can usually distinguish between elements that are required to make it complete, grammatically acceptable, and others that are additional circumstantial information that is not obligatory. And grammar describes this. Well, which parts are needed and how they're combined, and then where the other optional elements might be placed. Can you say, well, the asterisk helps you, can you say, I like in Spring Lancaster? No. Why not? Why is this ungrammatical? Well, because like requires something, an object, and it's typically the case that the object and the predicator need to be adjacent. I say typically because there are, of course, lots of exceptions. Language is always full of exceptions, but that's sort of a very general rule. And that is violated here. If we compare those two sentences, very easy sentences, the girl smiles versus the girls smile, okay, then we can say that these two sentences clearly have the same structure. In both cases, we have a subject which is made up of the plus a noun, and a verb, and it is a verb that doesn't require any further objects. The only difference is between, well, in the number of girls that are involved. So, plural versus singular. But that is not a question of grammar in the sense, well, not a question of syntax. This is morphology. The fact that you can't say the girls smile, or at least not if you speak standard British English or standard American English, has to do with the fact that grammatical rules consist of both structural rules, where you put things in a sentence, and inflectional rules depending on things like person or plural and things like that. Again, this is a grammatical rule which is violated. If you have a singular noun as a subject, you need to have a singular verb. And you learn that kind of thing in your first year in high school, I guess, when you start with English. Well, nowadays you start much earlier. Notice that if I compare those two sentences, then I have the same thing involved. Well, one girl or several girls. But it isn't a problem. Nothing happens to the verb. Both are fine. Why? Well, I think for everyone that's easy to see, because the girls is now in a different part of the sentence. It's in a different function. And that function doesn't seem to be dependent on the same types of rules. There isn't a relationship between the verb and the girls in the same way as with the first sentence that I gave you. Right, to sum up, we can talk about placement of parts in a sentence, and then we're talking about syntax. When we're talking about the correct word form in a position in the sentence, or for a position in the sentence, then morphology kicks in. And that's why together, morphology and syntax are typically considered to make up grammar. Now we will concentrate a lot on the syntax part for the next few weeks. I'd like to introduce a term that you find sometimes mentioned in the literature, which is the rank scale, which is sort of the different levels of description that you can have in terms of the structure of language used in a text. We start with the smallest unit, the smallest unit being a phoneme, which is the smallest meaning distinguishing unit in a language. The next level higher up is a morpheme, which is the smallest meaningful unit in a language. Then we have a word, which may consist of a single morpheme, but it may also consist of many morphemes together. So that's why it's higher up in the structure, in terms of structure. Words make up phrases. Phrases make up clauses. Clauses make up sentences. And then sentences form a text, or possibly discourse, if we're talking about spoken language. Now, really, I should have put this the other way around, because text is on top. Yeah. But, now, everything that's read is concerned with syntax. And that's what I'd like to focus on for the next few weeks. So we'll be talking more about words. Well, we've done that mostly. Phrases that make up clauses, and clauses that make up different types of sentences. And as I said, I think you know much of this already. I just need to revive it. Okay, here's the sentence again. I think that I'm not sure whether I've shown you. Have I shown you this before? Girl stumbled. Well, anyway, it's a simple sentence. This one is a bit more complex or complicated. The girl heard that I blew the whistle. Can you just, because we're now halfway through, for a minute or two, determine the phrase boundaries, or where you can cut up things that belong together, that have functions in a sentence, and name these phrases? What are they? Yeah. So I'll give you a minute or two where you can chat or think about the structure of this sentence. Okay, let's continue. Weekend will be there soon, don't worry. Okay, most of you, no, all of you, I'm sure, will have seen that the girl forms a unit. Basically, we've said this before. It's a noun phrase. Now, if you now said subject, then of course you were right. But that's not a name of a phrase. Okay? That's function. Okay, I didn't make this 100% explicit. I was looking for form. Stumbled is the verb. I already introduced the term predicator. We can also call this a verb phrase. Okay. This is only one word, but it's a verb phrase. Why? Well, because potentially there is more than just the verb. If I have a sentence like, I like cheese, then like cheese is a verb phrase. And there is more than a verb alone, because the verb is a kind of verb that requires something to be liked. So you'll see this repeatedly, that there is only one word, but in fact it's a phrase. And I'd like to motivate this further with examples in a minute. So that's easy. Noun phrase, verb phrase. And in fact, many simple sentences have this structure. Noun phrase, verb phrase. Now I got it. Okay. This one is a bit more difficult. The girl heard that I blew the whistle. The easy bit is the girl, which again, of course, is a noun phrase. What is the whistle? Another noun phrase. What else do we have? I. It's a pronoun, but we'll put this under noun phrase as well, because, well, as it already is in the noun, in the name, pronoun, well, actually, as I will say in a later lecture, it's actually not, it's a misnomer. It shouldn't be pronoun, it should be pronoun phrase. But we'll come to that. Do we have any verb phrases in this sentence? Well, blew the whistle. That is clearly a verb phrase. Now, if you determine, or if you want to determine what the necessary parts, or the function, no, well, the elements carrying functions are in a sentence, then the concept of participants is quite helpful. Somebody blows the whistle, and the whistle is being blown into. So it's like when you either want to stage it in a theater or something like that. For the verb kick, well, you need two actors, you need two participants. One does the kicking, and one is on the receiving end. Okay. On the other hand, if you have a verb like give, you give somebody something, then you need another participant. Okay. Now, is blew the only verb phrase, or blew the whistle, the only verb phrase in the sentence? Well, there's another verb, and I'm sure you've all found that, heard. Where are the phrase boundaries? What's the verb phrase of the main clause? Well, heard that I blew the whistle. So basically, the main clause, or the verb phrase in the main clause, includes something at a lower level. So, that I blew the whistle is basically the subordinate clause, as we will call it. And that's part of the verb phrase in the main clause. In fact, you can replace it with me. Then there is no subordinate clause anymore, but it's still the same verb phrase in terms of structure. Well, not entirely, of course, but the same basic principle. So, what does that lead us to? A situation where we seem to have three noun phrases, two verb phrases, And that's a bit of a mess. We need more structure in this. And that's where another extremely important word comes in, which is going to keep us busy for the next 3-4 weeks, and that's hierarchy. We didn't talk much about hierarchy in morphology. We could have, but I think it's not that interesting in the concept in context of morphology. For example, unhelpful. Is it first unhelp or first helpful and then unhelpful? Well, probably the second, definitely the second. But with some verbs, it's not clear how the hierarchy is made up. In morphology, this is something for the specialists. In syntax, that's the absolute basics, because syntax is all about hierarchy, about where in the hierarchy individual phrases and clauses are. Before we look at this in more detail, a quick look at the functions, because that helps us determine the hierarchical situation in the sentence. Can you find a subject? That's easy. Okay, the girl, right? Any others? I, yes. Okay. So both the girl and I are subjects. How can you have two subjects in one sentence? Well, that's where the hierarchy comes in. I blew the whistle. Subject is clearly I, if this is a sentence on its own. But we seem to have a situation where we have two subjects in one sentence. What's the object?
The whistle.
The whistle. Okay, good. Thank you. The whistle is object of the verb to blow. Any other object? Yeah, exactly. That I blew the whistle. Is that a phrase? No, it's not a phrase. It's a clause. Just now when I was describing the term, the sentence, I used the term subordinate clause, and I think most of you know what this is. But the function of the subordinate clause is that of an object. Quick definition of a clause. A clause is something that typically consists of at least one noun phrase and a verb phrase. Well, of a noun phrase and a verb phrase, minimally. Yeah. I say typically because, of course, there are exceptions, and we will see those exceptions. We will look at them in more detail. But that's sort of the, if you look at a short sentence that consists of one clause that stands on its own, you will typically see that it's a noun phrase and a verb phrase. There may be, typically are, several phrases in a clause, therefore. It's only untypically that there's only one phrase in a clause. And sometimes, in terms of functions, you can use a clause where you might otherwise use a phrase. In other words, they have the same function. I heard him, and I heard that he blew the whistle. Whether I say him or that he blew the whistle, both have the same function, namely object. One is a phrase, the other one is a clause. This is difficult to imagine in your mind if you don't see it. There are various ways in which linguists have tried to visualize this. One of them is brackets, where you sort of put square brackets about the individual parts of a sentence. You can do this, but it soon becomes very difficult to read. You can then try putting different colors. It gets very messy. A much, much better way of doing it, and you were briefly exposed to this already in lecture one, is a syntax tree. A tree which grows sort of upside down, so to speak. And a very simple tree for a very simple sentence would look like this. We first start with the word classes, the lowest of the four elements of the rank scale that relates to syntax. And then we put together words into phrases. So the girl is a noun phrase. It functions together. Stumbled is in fact a verb phrase on its own. It just, there is nothing that needs to be stumbled because that's not that kind of verb. And then on top we put S for sentence. And we can see the simple structure, noun phrase, verb phrase, very basic sentence. Easy. Slightly more difficult. The girl heard that I blew the whistle. We still have the girl, which is a noun phrase. And we still have a sentence, we always have an S on top. We have a verb, heard, and we know that heard is a kind of verb that requires an object. So we can say it must be head of a verb phrase. Now how do we put the rest together? Well, I is a noun, it's a pronoun, but in this sense it's a noun, which in fact is also at the same time a noun phrase on a higher level. And we have blew the whistle as verb determiner, or article as some people call it now. The whistle together is a noun phrase, the object of blew. Blew the whistle is the verb phrase. And we can put I blew the whistle, which could stand on its own together as a sentence. And then we've got this that, which I will at the moment just leave open. I won't label it as the thing that combines the two clauses in a hierarchical structure, into a hierarchical structure. Okay? And this bit here, as you can see, there is an S on top. It looks like a normal sentence, it's just that it's got this little appendix here, which attaches it to a higher level in the clause. So this is what a subordinate clause looks like, for example. And if we now, and this is going to be a test that we will be using later on in the next, or the one after that lecture, we can replace all of this with a single word, namely me. Structurally, on one level, namely the highest, nothing changes. But, of course, on a lower level, meaning below this node, a lot of things change. Now, in order to describe these things, it's useful to know some terminology. This is a sort of stylized tree with elements in it, and these elements are called, kinship terms in linguistics for certain things. This is the mother. And, well, daughter, I guess, yeah. And the two nodes which are on the same level are sisters. And off a node, we have different branches. That's why it's a tree. And elements which are dominated by one node, so C and D, which are immediately dominated by Z, form, and that's a really important term, form a constituent. So a constituent is an element which hangs on one particular node. And I could sometimes, if I want to change something in a sentence, take the whole thing and move it somewhere else. And I can only do this if I take everything under that node. I can't leave some word behind. So a constituent consists of everything that is dominated by one node. And it might be quite a lot. but there is only one note on top of it in the hierarchy. So, for example, there are quite a few constituents here. This one is a constituent because it is dominated by one node and it contains dit and m. The whole subordinate clause is one constituent. You could, in a very, well, you could change this to a different structure, well, not structure, but order, and say that I heard the whistle the girl heard, but that I did this she didn't hear. It's a very sort of stilted way of phrasing it, but you can do this. But then you need to move everything under the node S to the front. And you can't just leave the whistle, for example, behind. That's because it's a constituent which carries one particular function or which performs one particular function in the sentence. And it's usually difficult to separate them. And of course, this is a constituent as well. Now, I would like you to draw a tree. Actually, I'd like you to draw two trees. And I'd like to give you at least 5 minutes for this. If you want an easier sentence, you take the first one. If you like the challenge, you take the second one. Start with words. Think about which words belong together and therefore form phrases. And then think about what functions they have. And then draw trees. So I'll be quiet for a few minutes, and then we'll look at this together, and then I'll let you off a few minutes earlier again. In fact, sorry, that he likes chocolates sounds at least a bit odd. I think I put an S too many, right? But he likes chocolate. Okay. Sorry about that, but it has no impact on the tree. 30 seconds. Okay, let's see how far you got, or whether you got the same as I propose. Let's start with the first of the two. And I think the word classes are going to be very, very easy. Lancaster is a noun, is a verb, determiner a historic adjective, and town is noun. Is a noun. And Lancaster, even though it's only one word, is a noun phrase. Because in the same slot, we might have much longer items or elements that are still a noun phrase. Now, this is something that maybe you were wondering about. What do I do with adjective? A historic town is clearly a noun phrase. But what is historic? Well, historic is an adjective phrase rather than just an adjective. It is also just an adjective. But in fact, as you will hopefully over the next few weeks see, it makes a lot of sense to also call it a phrase. Why? Well, think about how you would put this into a tree if it said Lancaster is a very historic town. Then the very says more about the historic. It pre-modifies historic. And if you take out historic, or historical, whatever you prefer, then you also at the same time have to take the very. You can't say Lancaster is a very town. You can say it's a very historical town, or you have to delete both. So it's a phrase because there is the potential for more to be there. It just isn't there. In the same way as there is the potential to be more in this slot. Come on. Here we don't want to add anything because it's a proper noun. But with something like men stumble or men often stumble, something like that. Men, old men, old heavy men, old men with long beards, who, etc. All of this is one noun phrase. Okay. Now we've put all of this together in one noun phrase. And then link it up via the verb phrase to the sentence. Okay? A simple structure as such, noun phrase, verb phrase. It's a simple sentence. It contains the verb phrase, is a historic town. By the way, we will talk more about this. A historic town is not an object. But we'll come to that. See some puzzled faces. I'll clear those later on. Well, not today. Okay, that was easy, I hope. No? That he likes chocolate. Here I didn't write the S, so it clearly was a typo before. That he likes chocolate is obvious. Noun, he likes verb. Chocolate noun is verb obvious adjective. Okay, so far so good. He is a noun phrase. He likes chocolate is a sentence, well, is a clause, which consists of a noun phrase and a verb phrase. We have another verb phrase, namely, is obvious. What is obvious? An adjective. But again, it's not only an adjective, but it's also an adjective phrase, because it could be very obvious, extremely obvious. And again, those would belong together. So there is the potential for more in the structure. And then, well, now I've labeled it comp, or this is some sort of slot which seems to link things, because what is it actually? It's two clauses again that are put together via this that. Comp for complementizer, as we might call it. Now, bonus question. Or maybe not so bonus, I don't know, maybe this is simple. Sorry? What is this function, yes?
Subject.
Yes. Can everyone see that? All of this performs the function of subject. If I say something like, this is obvious, or the man is happy, then you have no difficulties in saying that this or the man is the subject. But what we actually have here is a whole clause which functions as a subject. So in other words, form and function can differ quite a lot. In many, many cases, the subject will be a noun phrase. That's the default. There is a correlation between form and function. Many subjects are noun phrases. But this is not a noun phrase. It's a clause. It's a subordinate clause. But it performs the function of subject. So, form and function are related, or there are correlations, but there is no one-to-one mapping. And in fact, there may be many different forms that can realize one particular function. And that's what we're going to look at over the next few weeks. This lecture was, I think, very, very easy in many ways. I introduced a few concepts that you may not have labeled in the same way before. But this was the absolute basics. Word classes. This is Ling 101. This is much earlier than that. Okay. Form and function. I think you should have heard about this before. If you haven't, it doesn't matter. Now you have. We need to build up on that. It'll get more complex. It'll get more interesting as well. Next lecture, it's going to be more on phrases and clauses. I will ask you to do some more tree drawing. And you'll also get the chance to get more practice, and then a bit more practice, and possibly a little bit more practice. See you next Friday.